song, and this is today's hit music.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, you will hear reports from Andrew Smith and Brian Lynn. Later, we present this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. History series. But first, Andrew Smith reports on the massive earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria.
A powerful 7.8 earthquake struck large areas of southern Turkey and northern Syria early Monday. At least 2,300 people were killed. The number of dead and injured will likely increase as rescue workers continue to search through the remains of destroyed buildings. The earthquake was centered 23 kilometers east of Nurdagi in the Turkish province of Gaziantep. It struck at 4:17 in the morning, local time. Many aftershocks have hit the area since the first quake. In addition, a powerful earthquake of magnitude 7.5 struck 9 hours later, a little more than 100 kilometers away. On the Syrian side, the affected area includes rebel-controlled territory, where buildings have already been weakened from fighting in the country's civil war. The opposition-held areas in Syria contain about 4 million people displaced from other parts of the country by the fighting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said 45 countries have offered to help his country in the rescue efforts. He said that over 2,800 buildings in Turkey had collapsed. Because the debris removal efforts are continuing in many buildings in the earthquake zone, we do not know how high the number of dead and injured will rise, Erdogan said. A hospital in Turkey collapsed. And in Syria, patients, including newborn babies, were taken out of medical centers. In Turkey, people tried to flee affected areas by car, slowing efforts of emergency teams trying to enter the areas. Religious buildings in the affected areas were opened to provide shelter for people unable to return to damaged homes in the cold winter weather. In the Syrian rebel-held town of Jandaris in Aleppo province, a pile of concrete, steel rods, and clothes lay where a building once stood. There were 12 families under there. Not a single one came out. Not one, said one young man. Monday's powerful earthquake was felt as far away as Cairo, Egypt. people living in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, were awakened by the quake. And in Syria's capital, Damascus, locals rushed into the street, fearing the collapse of buildings. The Syrian White Helmets is a rescue service in rebel-held territory, known for pulling people from the ruins of buildings destroyed by airstrikes. The group said they were in a race against time to save the lives of those under the rubble. Madevi Sun Swon is a spokesperson for the UN Office for Coordinating Humanitarian Affairs in northwestern Syria. She said, "We have been dealing with weather events and snowstorms, but nothing on the scale of an earthquake of this magnitude. It just adds on to all the layers of suffering," she said. Syrian state television showed images of rescue teams searching for survivors as icy rain fell. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad held an emergency cabinet meeting to go over the damage and discuss the next steps, his office said. Turkey sits on top of an area of major fault lines. The country is often shaken by earthquakes. About 18,000 people were killed in a similarly powerful earthquake that hit northwest Turkey in 1999. I'm Andrew Smith.
American music star Beyoncé broke the record for most career Grammy wins at the National Recording Academy's awards ceremony Sunday in Los Angeles. The singer added 4 Grammy Awards to her collection, bringing Beyoncé's lifetime total to 32. This broke the old record held by music conductor Georg Solti. "I'm trying not to be too emotional," Beyoncé told the crowd after her historic win. The singer thanked her late uncle, her parents, husband Jay-Z, and her children for supporting her. "I'm just trying to receive this night. I want to thank God for protecting me. Thank you, God," she said. During the show, Beyoncé was nominated for a Grammy for Album of the Year for her latest work, Renaissance, but she lost in that category to British singer and actor Harry Styles. Styles took home the Album of the Year award for Harry's House, and also won 2 other Grammys. It was the 4th time Beyoncé had been nominated for Album of the Year, an award she has never won. On Sunday night, the artist won Best Dance Electronic Music Album for Renaissance, Best Dance Electronic Recording for Break My Soul, Best R&B Song for Cuff It, and Best Traditional R&B Performance for Plastic Off the Sofa. Among the other top Grammy winners were hip-hop star Lizzo, who went home with the Record of the Year award for her single About Damn Time. She dedicated the award to Prince, saying the late artist had a big influence on her to make positive music. Lizzo also thanked Beyoncé for helping guide her career. She noted a time she missed school in fifth grade to see Beyoncé perform in concert. "You clearly are the artist of our lives," Lizzo told the singer. Blues singer Bonnie Raitt won the award for Song of the Year for Just Like That, a single about organ donation. Raitt, who also won two other awards, said, "I'm so surprised, I don't know what to say." I'm Brian Lynn.
Indoor plants are a beautiful way to brighten up your home, especially in the gray months of winter. But there can be a dark side to houseplants if you have children, or if children visit your home. It is important that you know which plants are toxic to young, curious humans. Gardening expert Jessica Damiano recently wrote about the issue for the Associated Press. She said she often points out houseplants in friends' homes that should be kept out of children's mouths. "I don't mind dashing friends' hopes of an Instagram-worthy indoor jungle if it means preventing harm," Damiano wrote. Caitlin Brown works at America's Poison Centers in Arlington, Virginia. She told the AP, "We get an average of 33,000 calls a year from people whose kids put different plants in their mouths." She added that the cases usually involve children under three because they explore their environment, she said, and they put everything in their mouths. "Most accidental exposures are not serious," Brown said. "But in some cases, a child's breathing, skin, and eyes can be badly harmed." Damiano wrote that she recently visited her cousin's home and saw a Diefenbachia plant in the kitchen. Her cousin told her that her young son, who had just begun crawling, had shown interest in the leaves. Damiano had to explain to her cousin that eating a small amount of the plant's stem can cause temporary but severe pain. The plant parts can cause throat and mouth swelling. The plant's sap can cause nose, skin, and eye pain. Other plants that can cause similar reactions include caladium, flamingo flower, Swiss cheese plant, peace lily, zizi plant, philodendron, and pothos. Amaryllis and its relatives, including clivia and daffodil, contain lycorin, a toxic substance that can cause a range of stomach issues. Damiano wrote that parents should teach their young children not to put non-food plant parts into their mouths. Parents should also educate themselves, she said. She urges parents to research whether the plants in their homes are safe to grow around children. She also suggests learning the official botanical names of any houseplants so that they are able to provide that information quickly to a poison control expert if needed. Not all houseplants are problematic, of course. Spider plants are non-toxic and also among the easiest indoor plants to grow. African violets, Boston ferns, Christmas cactus, wax plants, parlor palms, radiator plants, prayer plants, and baby's tears are other safe choices. I'm Ashley Thompson.
Now, Ashley joins me to talk more about this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Dan.
In the report, gardening expert Jessica Damiano explains how she sometimes has to tell parents that the plants they have inside their homes are unsafe for young children. In fact, she says that she does not mind dashing friends' hopes of an Instagram-worthy indoor jungle if it means preventing harm. Can you explain what the word dashing means here?
Of course. Dash has many meanings. It can be a verb, a noun, or even an adjective. In this case, to dash means to ruin or destroy. A common expression, which we heard here, is to dash someone's hopes. In other words, you do or say something that damages their hopes of something happening.
Got it. And can you talk a little more about other common meanings of dash?
Sure. As a verb, to dash can also mean to run quickly and suddenly. A dog might dash across the street, for example. As a noun, a dash is a punctuation mark. It is a simple straight line, and it serves to show a break in thought in a sentence. The noun dash can also mean a very small amount of something. You might need to use a dash of salt in a recipe. Believe it or not, there are even more meanings of dash, but I think I will stop there today.
I think that sounds good. Thanks for the explanation, Ashley.
You're welcome.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed 4 successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the 3 men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned, when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C., on July 2, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling, too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.